Hey, again, welcome to another day of this meditation retreat. The days are going fast, which is great because you're one day closer to your enlightenment than you were yesterday. There's one day less of samsara you have to endure. Isn't that wonderful? So if you look upon it that way, that life can be fun and a positive attitude. And there's still plenty of time to get fully enlightened, at least partially enlightened, at least a fraction enlightened, at least an itsy-bitsy bit enlightened. By this stage you're desperate for anything. But today's talk, as I promised last night, is a little bit about the really deep and the powerful insights. Because yesterday I talked about the jhana, but I never went into full detail is why we have those jhanas and what we do with them afterwards. And how they give rise to these amazing insights, which change your life, which destroy your attachments, which send cravings sort of hurtling to the ends of the universe, never to come back again, and which free you into infinite bliss forever. Oh, what joy. Now, how that happens is as follows. First of all, when you come out of those jhanas, number one, I'm going to start talking about the reflection on dukkha and suffering, the Four Noble Truths. Because you know what, some of which, then I'll do anicca, then anatta if I've got time. But anyway, many of you might have listened to me talk or read it yourself, which the Buddha said, it's because not understanding the Four Noble Truths that people keep getting reborn. They're not enlightened. And if you fully understand the Four Noble Truths, then you are an arahat, no longer subject to rebirth. So do you know the Four Noble Truths? Then you must be all enlightened. Isn't that the case? What's going on there? What's the first Noble Truth? Dukkha, yeah. Second Noble Truth? Sorry? The origin dukkha, which is? Craving, yes. The third Noble Truth is? The way out of it, the end of craving. And the fourth Noble Truth is? Yeah, they went, so you're enlightened, Dr. Banda. Is that the case? No, there must be something very strange there. We all know the theory. At least we think we understand the Four Noble Truths, but do we understand them completely? And that's the trouble. That's the difference between being enlightened and being an ordinary person. If you can understand the Four Noble Truths 90%, or even 99%, or 99.9999999%, you're still not enlightened. It's got to be 100%. Now I'm going to start off by understanding the second and third Noble Truths first of all, because these are really, really great. What's the second Noble Truth? Craving. Is it any type of craving? Is it craving for jhanas? Very interesting.
Except for the craving to nibbana,
there's that. The craving to nibbana, yeah, because that leads out of suffering. That's why it's very fascinating. And some monks have noticed this and actually commented on it, but without really understanding. If ever you look in Venerable Nyanatiloka's Buddhist dictionary, under the attachments, upadana, it's very strange. Because he said, look, I've noticed the attachments or the attachments to jhanas are not in here. There must be some mistake. And he actually says that maybe the Buddha made a mistake. It really should be in one of these other two. But whenever you think the Buddha made a mistake, the chances are you're making the mistake, not the Buddha. In other words, there's something you're not seeing there. And the craving of the second Noble Truth is a craving for sensuality, the five senses. Because it's called karma dhanha, the craving for that five sense world. That's number one, the craving to exist, called bhava dhanha, and the craving just to not exist, to let everything go, to get rid of things, vibhava dhanha. Now that first one, the craving for the five senses, some people just think it's just a craving to have no fun in the five senses, a craving for the extra slice of toast, or the craving for sex, or the craving for the movie, or the craving to turn on the TV and see what's happening in the test match, or whatever other craving you have. But it's not just the craving to have happiness of the five senses, it's even the craving to have any of the five senses. It's a craving for those senses to be there for you. Which is, you see that craving when you're meditating and maybe the hands start to disappear. You're like, I can't feel anything. Or the breath disappears. I can't notice the breath. Because we so identified with the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching, when those get taken away, it's like we're disappearing. Our ego, our entity, is just vanishing. And that's scary. That's what attachment is. Remember, when you call attachment, it's not so much what you're attached to. It's also what's doing the attaching. It's one of those reflections which I often did. Because as a monk, you know, you give up sex. You know, you have to be celibate as a monk. So as soon as I gave up sex and celibacy, I noticed together with all the other young monks, you really get into food. Now young monks eat a lot. And I realized because I was actually substituting my sensory pleasure, which would be with the girlfriends before, and now it's with food. And so I'd given up one thing, now I had to give up food. And I give up food, and then maybe sort of cups of tea. And you give up cups of tea, and you pick up something else. And this attachment business was so difficult. As soon as you let go of one thing, I'd be picking up another thing. And that's what it's like in life sometimes. You say to yourself, okay, no more sugar. So you give up sugar, and then you have more coffee. Or you give up coffee, and you have more cakes. We give up cakes. It's always something else you go and attach to. And it was my own insight, I thought. Instead of looking at what you're attached to, look at who's doing the attaching. Look at this side of attachment. And that was far more interesting. Not the objects of attachment, but the whole thing which does the attachment. And that's where you saw that that was me. That was how I asserted my independence, my existence, who I thought I was. By holding on to things, and all that I hold on to, all I attached to, that became me. That's how you make a self. And one of those places which we attach on to is our sensory experience. So if anybody says you're losing your hearing or you're going blind, people get very, very scared. Because it's as if their world has been taken away from them. They're losing an attachment. Now, this is also why many people are scared silly when they're about to die. What's wrong with dying? Nothing at all wrong with dying. Everybody knows it's dead, it's a nice experience. It's much better than being alive. Trust me. You don't have itchy nose when you're dead. When the mosquitoes land on you, because there's been quite a few the last few mornings and evenings. So if you're a dead corpse, mosquitoes can go for their life. They can eat whatever they want. Doesn't really matter, because you can't feed it anymore. Isn't it more wonderful? Do they have mosquitoes up in heaven? What happens to the good mosquitoes? Do they get reborn in heaven? Or do they all go to hell? Anyway, we'll leave that aside. But the point is, sort of, you know, the sensory experiences are just really, actually what the Buddha said, they're on fire, they're irritating. But we only realize how irritating they are when we left them alone in those jhanas. That's one of the first times we can actually overcome the craving for the five senses. We can let them go. Because we realize that when they are gone, oh, what a relief. Ajahn Chah's story is similar. I've used it in many different contexts, but I'm going to use it now. Is that once there was this young man, and he was born with two demons holding a tight rope around his neck, and he was being strangled. And these two demons never let up. As he grew up, as he went to school, as a young man, these two demons were still tying this rope around his throat. He could hardly breathe, but he got used to it. As you do, you sort of accommodate yourself to the difficulties of your body. And he never noticed any difference. But one day he came to a retreat just like this. And because of the teachings, those two demons fell asleep, and they loosened their grip on the rope around his neck. Ah, for the first time he could breathe. Oh, what bliss. He never realized that he could have so much peace and happiness. Now, when the demons loosen their tight grip on his throat. And that's like the five senses, holding the grip so your mind cannot be free. And this is actually what it feels like when you get into the deep meditations. Your five senses disappear. Oh, what a relief. That is the main cause for the bliss of the first jhana. So only when the first jhana you understand what the craving for the senses is. Too many people still say it's the craving for the happiness of the senses. As long as you have senses but you don't care whether it's happy or suffering, it doesn't matter. But you can't do that. If you have senses, it's the nature of the mind to seek for the happiness. It's nature. But what you can do, you can drop the whole sense world altogether. The whole caboodle. And then there's no pain of the five senses anymore. That particular part of dukkha, it's a huge part, has dropped. You never realized how much suffering it was, being born as a human being. It's not just when things go wrong that you're suffering. It's not just when you get separated from what you like, or when you're sick or you're about to die with cancer. It's even when you're in your beautiful moments. Even now, if I could flip a switch and put you into jhana straight away, you'd realize how this moment was suffering. Literal pain. But we can't see that because we got used to those two demons tying that rope around our neck. So this is how I mean you can actually understand something a bit more about the nature of suffering. There's some part, because it's been there all the time, we're used to that suffering, and so we don't know anything better. It's like sometimes there's been people who had migraines, permanent ones, and never let up. And then some doctor comes along with some magic potion, and your migraine's gone. Oh, people who have that sickness for long periods of time, and suddenly a magic bullet comes along, and sometimes there are magic bullets, it's very rare, but it does come along. Oh, you get blissed out. You had all that pain and suffering, and now it's completely gone. A miracle. Oh, so good. This is what's happening with the five senses. After a while, if you get into those jhanas, you realize you've got the magic bullet, at least for a short time anyway, and you understand the five senses is suffering. You understand what that first craving, the cause of suffering is. If you can't see that, you don't know that, you'll always go towards the five senses. And when you die, you get reborn with more five senses. You'll never be able to let them go. You'll never be able to be free from samsara. The bhavadanha is a craving to exist, just to be. And this is fascinating because I've been on bedsides when people are dying and they've been just so in so much pain. But they won't let themselves go. They won't just allow the death process to happen and just disappear. Because they'd rather be in agony than not be at all. At least that's what they think, that death is some sort of black hole, they're going to disappear, and they'd rather be experienced at least pain. Now remember this one story from this book, there's another book written by this American guru, come hippie, Ram Dass. He was just this really long-haired hippie in the old days, and he said that when he went to visit the United States, he had one of his disciples, and his disciple, and this young girl, her father was dying of some terrible disease in hospital in constant pain. They couldn't find any medicine to get rid of the pain. And so, you know, she asked him out of desperation, "You're supposed to be a holy man, come and visit my father." And so he walked up into the hospital room, and his father, and this was maybe 30 years ago, was just an ordinary sort of Joe from New York somewhere. He suddenly saw this weird guy with long hair and hippie beads coming in his room. He said, "Get out." But, you know, Ram Dass just, you know, stayed in the background there, while his daughter started talking to him. Now, his daughter started talking to the father and just reassuring him, which you do by the bedside. And this guy, Ram Dass, you know, not realizing he couldn't talk to the father, he decided, you know, his feet were poking out the end of the bed, to give him a foot massage. And reflexology can be very amazing. And Ram Dass was there, giving him a foot massage, and suddenly the guy stopped talking to his daughter, because for the first time in weeks his pain had disappeared. Completely gone. And he was so shocked, he said, "Get off my feet!" He'd rather have the pain and have his whole philosophical framework of reality intact than actually get his pain removed by something he just completely didn't understand. It's amazing just our attachments and how we'd rather exist than actually be free from pain. Now that craving to exist, you start to see that when you just will not let go. Because letting go means you're disappearing. Not doing things, not controlling, not making the meditation happen, means you are not important anymore. You are irrelevant to the whole process. You don't count. And we say, oh, well, I do count. See, I'm here. And you start messing things up. See, that shows you're still there. At least I'm here. That attachment to being somebody is why we do so much. It's the old story. And this was graffiti on the walls of the philosophy department at Cambridge University when I was a student. Because later, I don't know if it came from me, but it came from somewhere else. They saw it on like a birthday card. You know, they always put these jokes on these funny birthday cards or Christmas cards, and someone had actually written on a Christmas card. And it was, to do is to be. And that Descartes. Yeah, thank you. Descartes, many Descartes. They quoted him, to do is to be. And Jean-Paul Sartre turned it around. Said, no, it's not to do is to be is to do. And then the last quote was from an American philosopher, a modern one. Doobie doobie doo, Frank Sinatra. Students have a great sense of humour. But anyhow, the point is that those two philosophers, or the three philosophers if you like, they actually saw the connection between being and doing. If you don't do anything, do you exist? How do you find out if a person's dead? You poke them and see if they do anything. You shake them and see if they do anything. You see if their body is doing, if it's breathing or heart is doing anything. If they're not doing anything, that's a sign they're dead. If you go out into the garden, you see sort of something on the ground there. See if it's an animal or some strange insect. You see if it does anything. If it doesn't do anything, it's inanimate. So you can see the connection between doing and being. So when I'm encouraging you all to let go, not to do anything during this retreat, I'm killing you. I'm murdering you. I'm talking about serial killers like Angulimala. But I'm not just killing your body, I'm killing just the being inside. If I tell you you've got to do anything, that's what it feels like sometimes. That's why it's scary, that's why it goes against the grain. Now, I'd rather actually do something and achieve, even if I fail, at least I tried. But the point is that that's not the way of the Buddha. The way of the Buddha is completely let go of the doer. Until you complete this fear, there's no one left. Remember what I said, the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Great saying. Because the more you do your meditation, the more difficult it becomes. And sometimes it becomes impossible. Why? Because you're there. If you can somehow allow yourself to vanish, especially from the doing point of view, so you're not active anymore, you're not driving, you're not calling the shots, you're just sitting down. It's like being on the aircraft. Because I go on the aircraft very often, I travel around a lot, got a lot of complaints about that, but who cares. Whenever I go on the aircraft, I sit down in the seat, and once I'm sitting down on the seat, I don't do anything. You just sit there. People come and feed you. I don't go up to the pilot and say, look, I'm in a hurry today. Can you sort of take the shortcut? Or, you know, we're going over sort of Indonesia. Can you sort of swoop around Borobudur for dogs? I like to see it from the air. Because the pilot will not take any instructions from you. You just say to sit down. As I tell the joke, because they always say, sit down and enjoy the in-flight service. In meditation, we don't have in-flight service. We have insight service. So sit down, do nothing, and enjoy the insight service. And you don't have to go and get it, because these flight attendants in jhana, they come and bring you the insights. They come to your seat. And here you are, madam. What insights do you want today? We've got anicca, dukkha, anatta on the menu. Please make your choice. And it's all very delicious and very rich. That's the insight service. But the point is that the craving to do, why is it we can't let go? Why is it we've got nothing to do now? Absolutely nothing. You don't have any duties or very few duties to do. You don't have to cook. You don't have to decide the menu. You don't have to decide to talk. You don't have to decide when you're going to go up, when you're going to go to bed. You can all do whatever you want. So there's nothing to control. And that's really hard. And some people have told me it'd be much easier if this was more like, you know, the real concentration camps. And I wore a peaked hat. And all these monks wore black instead of like soft brown. And we made you goose step on the walking meditation path. No, free up, 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 up. And whenever you went past the box, instead of my Bhante, you go, hi-oh! Some people enjoy that more, simply because it's more in tune with the way that they work. The control freaks, bunch of fascist meditators. That's what you do, you're fascist sometimes. Come on, watch the breath. Come on, get up early. Come on. We have ways of making you get into jhana. Whatever it is, that sort of attitude is just really not what meditation is. That's craving to be. That's a bhavadana. A few of you, but you find that when you can't let go of the doing. Why is that? Why can't you just... You know that's possible. It's not going to get into any trouble. You know it's all going to go much more smooth, but you're letting go of yourself. That's what you're letting go of. That's why it's difficult. And the last one is vibhavadanha, is a craving to annihilate yourself. This is actually all coming from ill will. I don't like me. I want to get away. I want to zap out so I can't feel anything. The point is that you can't kill yourself. You can't crave for jhana. And the simile which I've often given is actually from Oliver the Twist. Sorry, not Oliver the Twist. Oliver Twist. But one of the characters in there, he always used to say that if Oliver comes back with a £5 note, he won't do it. If he does, I'll eat my own head, he used to say. And you know, Charles Dickens had this phrase, you know, to eat your own head. It's a fascinating thing to contemplate how you begin doing that. You may be able to eat your ears and cut off your nose and put that in your mouth, but there comes a point when it becomes impossible to eat anything more, otherwise you're eating the one doing the eating. And that's what the craving to annihilate yourself is. You can't do it. The Buddha said it's like a dog chasing its tail, trying to bite its own tail. You just can't get around to it. You can't annihilate, you know, the one doing the annihilation. This is a terrible, difficult thing. Which is why that this path of letting go, of doing nothing, you don't annihilate things, you let things fade away. You let things disappear. You don't make them disappear. If you understand that, you understand the difference between struggling in your meditation and having a smooth path into the deep jhanas. You don't do it. You get out of the way and let it happen. You can't annihilate the five senses and say, stop, I don't want to listen to you sound anymore. I don't want to feel you, body. You can't say to the thoughts, stop, I don't want to think anymore. Because as soon as you say stop, you thought again. There's a very deep joke, but it's an old joke, about the four monks, the vow of silence, one of them sneezed. The first monk said, bless you. Second monk said, you've broken your vow of silence. Third monk said, ha ha ha, so have you. The fourth monk said, I'm bad, I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. The point is, as soon as one says something, makes a comment, they've also broken the silence. Which is, if you try and stop the thought with a thought, you know, you can't do it because you've made another thought. And it goes round and round and round and makes you really confused. So the only way you can stop is by letting go. Which brings you actually on to that third noble truth, which is my favourite, like the end of craving. But it's great the Buddha actually said, not just, you know, end of craving, yeah, you can get an idea of that, but how do you do it? How do you stop this craving? And he gave four ways of letting go. And it's a great teaching. Four ways of letting go. First is chaga, patinisaga, muti, analaya. Chaga is giving. Liberality. Because whenever you give a donation, or you give some of your time, you know, you give a few minutes to wash up after lunch, you're giving. You're letting go. But there's two different types of giving. One is the real giving, the other one is the false giving. The false giving is when you give a donation and you want the tax receipt back in return. And you want your name on a sort of the building. Sort of, Dr. Banda gave, you know, this big hall. That's not giving, that's called business. It's like, you know, putting an advert because you buy advertising rights of your name and your generosity. And obviously that is not giving. Even if you give expecting something back in return, some praise, or some acknowledgement, or even some happiness back afterwards, that's not giving, that's doing business. So what giving is just giving, expecting nothing back in return. So, after we finish this talk, you can give 1 hour to meditation. But real giving, expecting nothing back in return. Can you do that? You just give the rest of this retreat to your cushion out of respect for the Buddha. So that's what you're supposed to do, just meditate. But you don't expect anything at all. That's what we mean by giving. Doing, expecting nothing back in return. Applying yourself, not anticipating any rewards. To be able to meditate, you don't expect even just being in the present moment or even the smallest piece of silence. You just do it for the sake of doing it. That's what giving is. Can you do that? If you can, you're on the path to Nibbana. You sit down there and don't expect. And so often it happens that people have been meditating all day and getting absolutely nowhere. So they decide, right, go back to their room and sleep. But they're not tired. And they don't want to come back in here. So they just, okay, I'll just sit for 5 minutes. Wham, bam, zoom, a deep meditation. Because they don't expect it. Or someone who comes in for the first time they meditate, haven't got a clue what they're doing, wham, bam, they get into deep meditation. Why? Because they didn't expect anything. They didn't know what was going on. It's that expectation is the opposite of real giving. When you don't expect anything back in return. So you can try that in your meditation. And you can sit here, watch the breath, and don't expect it's going to work. Don't expect anything. Just do it. If you can do that, then everything disappears. You're relaxed. The second one, Pati Nisaga, is literally abandoning, throwing things out. So see how much you can throw out. Not of your wallet, but of your mind. See how much you can abandon. Which is why that I sometimes give them the simile of meditation, like going up in a hot air balloon. I think I gave this simile earlier. You go up in a hot air balloon, and you go up so high, that's you've got your meditation so far. You can't go any higher. It must mean you've got some baggage you're carrying in the basket. So you look in there and you're sure there's still some past or future in your basket which you're still carrying in this retreat. Still some fears about what's going to happen next, even expectations about what's going to come for dinner or lunch today. And all the baggage from the past, what's happened to you so far in this retreat, let alone earlier. That's baggage in the basket. No wonder you can't go high. So this second one of Pati Nisaga, throwing things out, and seeing what's in there, just chucking it out. See what you can chuck out. Chuck out your husband, chuck out your wife, chuck out your kids, chuck out your business, chuck out your monastery, chuck out your monks, chuck out your diseases, chuck out everything. See how much you can throw away. Because you find when you get to a certain level of meditation, it's always you attached to something, this baggage there, which stops you going further. So you look around, you use your insight. What am I still carrying? And as soon as you notice that, it's very easy. As soon as you notice what the baggage is, you can let it go. It's noticing it is what's required. And then you can just jettison it. And you know you've jettisoned it if you go higher, if the meditation becomes more peaceful and more deep. Then you get to another level, you can't go any further. You look for some more stuff to throw out. You throw out time, you throw out thoughts. Now you've got to throw out your body. What are you so concerned with your body for? It's a complete waste of time. You've had gut ache for I don't know how many years. None of your business. Pain, aches, just throw it away. Why can't you throw it away? Because it's mine. That's why. There's an attachment there. If you cut that attachment and throw it out, it disappears. It's incredible you can actually do that. Even with the deepest of pains, you can sever the link, which is mine, M-I-N-E. It's hard to do, but you can do it. It's just chucking some more stuff out of the basket. But with the pain, the pleasure of the body goes as well.
So the whole body disappears. You're thrown out of the basket. And that's when you go into the nimitta realm. You can't feel the body, you can't hear things, because you've thrown away the body. And that's a big burden. You literally chucked it out. It doesn't belong to me. And then you've got to chuck out parts of the mind. That's where you've got to chuck out the doer. And then chuck out the knower. That's what I say in the hot air balloon. You get so high you can't go any higher. There's nothing left in the basket. And then you realize, ha, it's a basket. So you throw out the basket. That's the body. That's your basket, which you sit in. And I always often say, just most people's bodies are basket cases. Some are more frayed than others. But anyway, you throw off the basket and we're just holding on to the balloon by the strings. And that's when we let go of the body in the nimitta or the jhana realms. Nimitta realm, sorry. And then, what can we let go of now? When you're in nimitta, you want to get into jhanas. You have to let go of yourself. And that's when you let go of the ropes and the balloon goes into jhana realms, nibbana. You've disappeared. It's called giving away, letting go. And it's a very powerful meditation technique. I use that a lot. If I'm getting somewhere and some strange reason you can't go higher, you quickly look, you know, holding on to something there. There's some baggage there. As soon as you notice it, oh, that thing again, throw it away. And as soon as you throw it away, you're through. The next one is even more interesting and powerful, which is mutti, which is freedom. Be free like a bird, just flying through the sky. Doesn't carry any baggage. I've never seen a bird carrying suitcases or with a backpack. Not even with a fanny bag, they call it, isn't it, what they put on the front there with their wallet and money in it. They have nothing which they're carrying. They're just completely free. But they're not all that free. You can be much more free than that. The trick to being free, and many of you heard this story before, so I'll abbreviate it. When the monk went to go and teach in Kajarina Jail, one of the big prisons here in Perth, and just after he'd been teaching there many weeks, they invited him to stay behind for tea, because they wanted to find out what it's like in a Buddhist monastery. So he told them what it was like in our monastery down at Serpentine. You get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, but it's optional. You can always get up early if you want to, but not later. And they said, you don't have to get up in prison at 4 o'clock in the morning. That's disgusting. And you can't watch the TV because there's no TV in the prison. No, it's in prison, but not in my monastery. No TV, you've got to meditate all morning. You can have a breakfast, but sometimes many monks don't. And then you have to work really hard, much harder than prisoners have to work. And at 10 o'clock, 10:30, you have your meal in the bowl. Everything gets mixed together. And they say, even in prison, they have trays with different compartments, and you have a choice of what you eat. And then what do you do in the afternoon? Can you play sport? There is no sport in a monastery, no football, no tennis, not even table tennis, not even darts. Can you play poker? No, there's no poker either, no cards. Just meditate all afternoon. Oh, it's a bit tough, but I suppose you can hang out for your evening meal. And then he told them, in monasteries we don't eat dinner. The meal about 10:30, 11 is the last of the day. Wow, they would never get away with that, trying to force that on us prisoners. We'd riot. So what do you do in the evening? Is there any sex? No, we're monks. We just meditate. Can you play guitar or music, have a dance, sing song? No, we're just monks and meditate. And anyway, the monk went into much more detail than that. But the point was, those prisoners, they were amazed just how austere a Buddhist monastery is. But more than amazed, they liked this monk, and they felt very, very sad for him, that he had to endure such hardship, while they in prison had it much easier. And one of them forgot where they were and said, that's terrible in your monastery, why didn't you come in here and stay with us instead? And that's how I got to know the story. But it's true. A monastery is far more austere than any prison in Australia. But in a prison, people are waiting to get out. In a monastery, people are waiting to get in. Why? And this is where you understand the difference between freedom and being in a prison. In a monastery, the only difference is that people want to be there. In a prison, they don't want to be there. And that is the definition and meaning of a prison. Any place you don't want to be is a prison for you. If you're in a relationship you don't want to be, you don't like it, your marriage is a prison. It feels that way. If you're in a job you hate, your job is a prison. If you're in a meditation retreat, which you're fed up with, then these walls become a prison for you. Or if you're in a particular meditation, which you're not happy with, it's only first jhana, you want second, then it's a prison for you. It does not, the thing with the prison of my monastery, or your home, or whatever, it doesn't matter where you are. Even if you can be in the Hilton 5-star hotel room, if you don't want to be there, it feels like a prison for you. Any place you don't want to be is a prison. Now do you understand how to let go? Doesn't matter what you're experiencing in your meditation. If your mind is all over the place and you don't want to be there, it's exactly the same as if you're a nimitta but just itching to get into jhana. You don't want to be with a nimitta, you want to be somewhere else. Therefore it's a prison. And you're not free. You can't progress. But it doesn't matter what you're experiencing, if you're dull and sleepy, but you're happy to be here, then you know freedom. Mutti. It's not where you are, but where you want to be is the problem. So, if you want to be free, let go and be happy to be here, wherever that is. Doesn't matter how austere or how beautiful, just how painful or how pleasurable, that's irrelevant. If you don't want to be in that place, you've made yourself a jail, and it hurts. If you want to be free, be content with wherever you are. Whatever stage of meditation you're at, if you're content, then you feel this amazing freedom. And of course, that builds and builds and builds, and it ends suffering for you. Big time. So, can you see your mistake? How many times have you made a prison while you've been here in this retreat? I don't want to be here, I want to be somewhere else. I don't want to sort of be sitting here, I want to be in my room. I don't want to be in my room, I want to be walking. I don't want to be walking, I want to be home. I want to be in jhana, like Ajahn Brahm says. Yeah, that's where I want to be. And then, you're never happy where you are. And even when you do get something, and a few of you have got nimittas, you've got a nimitta and you're still not happy. Many people in this retreat would give their right arm to have a nimitta like you've had. And then they give thousands of dollars. And if I could say, if you give $1,000, you get a nimitta, okay, deal. But you're still not happy. Oh my goodness, you're so demanding in nature. So, just be happy where you are, and that's called freedom. And last one, analia, is actually having no place where things rest. That word alaya, people remember that from places like Himalaya. Hima means snow. Alaya means the abiding of the snows, Himalaya mountains. There's another state called Meghalaya in India. That's where Mega means clouds. That's where the clouds live. Alaya means like a roosting, a place where something goes to stop. So analaya means having no roostings at all, no places where anything sticks. The Teflon mind. So a thought of ill will comes in, and it goes out. It doesn't stick to you. Now, a nice, happy moment comes, and that too doesn't stick. You don't grab, grasp, and keep anything. It's like a Teflon mind. Whatever comes into your mind, you don't hold on to it. Because if you hold on to it, you can't go deeper. You're just accumulating experiences, accumulating more possessions. Not material possessions, but spiritual possessions. It's called spiritual materialism. You just keep on, and you go home and say, hey, have a guess what I achieved. I've got nimittas, I've got jhanas. And it's just like, you know, you read out your bank balance. It's just spiritual materialism. So, don't get into that. Just have nothing stick. You say, what happened? Nothing. Nothing much. Just enlightenment, jhanas, all that sort of stuff. But you really regard it, it's just nothing. Don't allow anything to stick. And that's analia. And it's a great thing because it means whatever happens in this meditation, you let it go immediately. As soon as it's happened, it's gone. Which is what life is like. As soon as you hear the sound, it's gone. You should meditate like experiencing the wind. You don't know where the wind comes from. You know it when it's just brushing past your face for a moment. You feel its caress. And after the caress has disappeared in a fraction of a second, there's no way you know where that wind has gone. You only know it in this moment. And all life is like that, whether it's an experience of jhana or sloth and torpor. So all it is, it's the moment's experience. And now it's gone. If you can do things something like that, having a Teflon mind, doesn't keep anything, then you are free again. You've let go of the world. We make our world through accumulated experiences. Through the interpretations which we keep. Unfortunately, we usually keep the shitty stuff, which is weird as human beings, why we do things like that. All the mistakes which happened in our life. That story Ajahn Chah said, the two chicken farmers, one went to his chicken shed early one morning, and he went with his basket and collected all the droppings. And he left the eggs to rot in the shed. And that was a very dumb chicken farmer. Chicken farmer two, number two, went to the shed in the morning, collected all the eggs, and left the chicken shit to rot. So he could make an omelette for his family and also sell the eggs for some money in the market. That was a smart chicken farmer. And that metaphor which Ajahn Chah often used said, which type of chicken farmer are you? When you go into your past, even like this retreat so far, what do you collect? Do you collect all the shitty meditations and feel really down upon yourself? Or do you collect the beautiful stuff and leave the bad stuff to rot in the past? So if you're going to collect anything, please collect the eggs. Forget about all the stuff which went wrong. Ah, who cares? Because you learn much more from your successes than you ever learn from your mistakes. We can only dwell on what went right in our life. Instead of dwelling on what went wrong, we'd be inspired, encouraged, and we'd repeat those successes. So please learn from your successes. Forget about the mistakes. Forgive them, let them go, disappear. But always remember your successes. You're going to remember anything. But the best of all is just to let everything go. And then you're completely free. And those are the four ways of letting go. Now can you understand why you don't understand the Four Noble Truths? Even the path of the Fourth Noble Truth. Still people don't understand what the jhanas are, and that's an important part of it. And even the first noble truth of suffering is too much. They don't realize it's suffering because it's there all the time. We've got used to it. Because we've got used to it, we think it's okay. It's like the person who's born in prison. They're born in prison, raised in prison, spent all their life in prison. This prison with the five big walls. And they think, oh, prison's okay. Sometimes a bit of suffering, but if you sort of go and paint the walls of your cell, maybe get a TV in there, maybe put a flower vase in the corner, oh, prison's not that bad. And other people, they become the compassionate people. And they go around painting other people's prison cells. And making other people's prison cells a little bit more happy. But prison is prison. It's suffering. And, as I mentioned, a long time ago, there was a special prisoner who built a tunnel. And that tunnel is there to this day. It's called Eightfold Tunnel. Which leads out of prison into freedom outside. And anyone can walk through it anytime they want, but they don't want to because they're used to prison. If you see these prisoners who've been in jail 40, 50 years, they just can't escape. But they get sort of their release order, they don't want to go. Because they're used to prison, and they like prison. It's real dummies. In the last story of my book, Opening the Door of the Heart, it's been translated into Thai, and I read it in Thai. The last story there too is The Worm in the Pile of Dung. The Worm and the Pile of Dung is a great story because there was this worm, actually it was two monks, started off with two monks, and one was a really, pretty good guy, the other one was really lazy and sloppy. And so when they died, one got reborn in heaven, the other one got reborn as a worm in a pile of dung. You can get reincarnated as an animal, sometimes even as a worm in a pile of dung, so be careful. And this monk even got reborn as a worm in a pile of dung, the other one got reborn in the heaven realm. Because they were mates, they were good friends. What would happen to you if you missed your friend? You'd think, oh, where's he got reborn? And the one in the heaven realm had all his psychic powers. Where's my friend been reborn? And he checked all the heaven realms. Couldn't find his friend anywhere there. That's really strange. Maybe he got enlightened. No, not him. He was just too lazy. I know, he's had a fortunate rebirth in the realm of human beings. So he used his psychic powers and saw all the realm of the human being. Still couldn't find his friend there. Surely not as an animal. But he, you know, checked out all the animals, all the nice dogs in the good home, the cats and, you know, the bigger animals. Couldn't find them there. Surely not one of the lower animals. And he searched, and sooner or later he found his friend. And one of the worst animal rebirths you could possibly have as a worm in a stinking pile of shit. Oh, what a rebirth that was. You can't let your friend down like that. So he appeared, using his magic powers, he appeared in front of the pile of dung. And he called out to his friend, "Hey, Venerable, it's me, do you remember me? We were monks in our past life. Now I've been reborn in this beautiful heaven realm. And it's just so nice and lovely, beautiful music, great food, everyone nice and peaceful and happy, just everything you ever want in life is there. Oh, it's just a wonderful place, heaven." And the worm stuck his head out. "Is it so wonderful?" "Oh, it's everything you ever want." So the worm said, "Any shit up there?" "Of course there's no dung up there. You don't have dung and shit in heaven. You probably don't have toilets in heaven. Do you think they have toilets in heaven? They can't have toilets because, you know, you don't need to go to the toilet. I don't know what happens to the food you eat or the ambrosia. It must have come out somewhere. But anyway, we'll leave that to some other people to think about. Then, if there's no shit up in heaven, I'm not going there." "We don't understand," said the heavenly being. "It's wonderful up there. It's just so happy and peaceful and nice. No shit, no go." And so the heavenly being, he didn't know how he could actually convince this stupid worm that heaven is a really nice place. So the only thing to do was actually to use force. So he held his nose, and this is a heavenly being, really refined, held his nose and put his very delicate hand into this pile of stinking mess and searched around for the worm, searching around, yeah. But for friendship, that's what you would do. Really good friends, that's how far they would go for you. When you're in the shit, they'd even come and try and pull you out. And so he got the worm and started tugging and tugging and tugging him. And the worm, "I don't want to go, I don't want to go, I don't want to go." And because he didn't want to go, and because he was all covered with this slime, he wriggled and squirmed and eventually he just escaped. But heavenly being was not going to give up that easily. This was my best friend. And for a best friend, oh, you really go to extreme lengths. He put his hand in again, again and again and again, trying to pull his friend out. But because his friend didn't want to go, in the end the heavenly being had to leave him to his pile of dung and go back up to heaven. Such a sad story. And the moral of that story is, for the last 6 or 7 days, I've been trying to pull you out of your shit. "Will you go?" "No, I don't want to go. Is there any TV up in Nevada? Is there any food? Is there any sex in Nevada? Oh no, I don't want to go." That's called attachment. It's a great story, but as you can see where it comes from there, you don't want to give up. That's because you haven't seen clearly enough that we actually, you know, all those things we delight in are just like being in a prison. And there is a path out there. We just need to go out first of all and have a quick peek and realize actually it's quite nice being free. And there's a four ways of freedom. So you understand here that sometimes that you need those huge insights for actually to get enlightened. As far as Anicca is concerned, it's not rise and fall, not things rising, going away again. Again, when I started learning Pali for myself, and I started off with a vinaya, with the monk's rules, because I'd noticed there were so many arguments and discussions in our monastery the first couple of years of what the rules were, what the rules weren't. And I thought, well, you know, someone's got to do some research and find out. So I got the books, learned some Pali, and started understanding what the rules were. And again, it was fascinating. You can actually see that sometimes even Ajahn Chah got it wrong. But it was, you know, he admitted it afterwards. You know, you could actually see it was tradition. It had gone down from teacher to teacher to teacher, and they maybe not have all the resources of all the books at hand. And you can actually see it and look at it and say, oh yeah, that's right. And one of the things which I noticed there, just reading through it in Pali, there was, when people would come to the monastery, just in the time of the Buddha, very similar today, you go maybe once a week to bring dana to the monks or to the sisters. And there's people here who go on a certain day every week. If it's a certain day every week, that is actually called nitya food. A regular supply of food comes one day every week, or one day a fortnight, or one day a month, or whatever. Nitya means regular. And the opposite of that is atnitya. And it means not just impermanent, it means something which was regular, which was always there, which was constant, is now no longer there. It's not just rise and fall. It's seeing something which was always there, which you never noticed, disappear. And it gives you a different understanding of what anicca is. And this is a big anicca. I've already mentioned that, what anicca is here. To see the body has always been there. Now it's completely taken away in jhanas. The body was nitya, was regular. The potential to do, the will, was regular. Always there. The five senses were always there. Many, many things in life were always there. Just like the tadpole in the water was always there. It was nitya, it was regular. A constant part of its life. So much so, you take it for granted, you can't even see it anymore. What's always there and regular, you become blind to. That's what delusion is. You think it's always. Your sense of self. The reason why you think you exist is because there's something which has always been there for you, which has been continuous and constant as long as you've known. You assume that's me, because of its constancy, because it's nitya. Now when that disappears, when that's anicca, that rocks you. It destroys that illusion. The water has disappeared. The self has gone. The body has gone. The will has gone. Too many things have disappeared. Regular things you could count on. Been counting on as long as you know are no longer there. That's shocking. The difference between rise and fall and this part of anicca. Anicca also means rise and fall, but this is its deeper meaning. It's like when a person is watching the waves on a lake. They see the waves rise and fall, rise and fall, rise and fall, but one day they're watching the lake and the whole lake disappears. And the land mass which surrounds it has also gone. Absolutely vanished. Now of course that's weird, it shouldn't happen, but it has. Then you realize this land mass and this lake, it's not real, constant. That's what it's like getting the insights into anicca. Things as shocking as lakes disappearing. And they shouldn't do. You've never seen that before. How can that happen? It goes against the laws of science. Or like you're watching a TV. And the TV has five channels on it. Sight channel, sound channel, smell channel, taste channel, and body channel. And you're watching that, and you can actually flip from one channel to another. And on the channels, there's many different programs. There's your favorite programs on the sound channel, Jimi Hendrix channel, and there's the ones you don't like, you know, politician speech channel. And on all these other channels, you can flip from one channel to the next. It's impermanent, rise and fall. But one day, it's even actually the special mind channel. You have to actually tune it very, very refined to get to the mind channel. But one day, you're watching the TV, and it's not just the channels disappear. The whole TV set vanishes. It's gone. There's no TV set anymore. My goodness, what's going on? And that's what it means, like the vanishing in the jhanas. Things just vanish. And TV sets are not supposed to vanish. It's not covered in the warranty. But it has. Now that's what anicca is like. You know, things you can't believe this, but it's the most real experience you've had. That's why it's called insight. It shocks one. It's the biggest kick up the bum you've ever had in your life, and you can't forget it. You realize just how so many assumptions you had, what created samsara, what created attachment, what created the illusion of the self, and now they're gone. And of course, that's the last of the reflections on anatta, non-self. So hard to see that. The reason is because it's obvious you're here. Even if you can ask that question, it means you're here, there's someone to ask it, surely. But this is where you need those experiences of all that's constant disappearing. In those deep meditations, you can start to see even consciousness itself fragment. I gave a simile in my book. It's like seeing a beach, this beautiful stretch of continuous white sand. You know, just like down in Cottesloe or wherever you live, Bondi, whatever. It's this beautiful stretch of white sand. It's so inviting. And you don't think twice about walking on it. But if you look a bit closer, that continuous stretch is not continuous at all. It's made up of little grains of sand. And if you look even closer, you find those grains of sand aren't even touching. There's actually a space in between where there's no sand at all. And that's a simile for consciousness. If you look closely, you find there are spaces between your consciousness. Consciousness is not continuous after all. It's granular. So, when one conscious moment is finished and another one is yet to arise, where are you? Where have you gone to? The answer is obvious. You haven't gone anywhere. You weren't anywhere in the first place. Nothing there. And I'll finish off this talk with one of my favorite anecdotes from my time with Ajahn Chah. This is a great teaching of my master on impermanence, suffering, and especially non-self. In his last years of teaching, it was actually just before I came to Australia. As soon as I came to Australia, about a month later, he went into the deep coma and could not speak anymore. So I got all his last teachings. But when he was getting sick, the Western monks, we've read Lavinia, and we saw that in the time of the Buddha, that they had saunas in the monasteries. Saunas were not invented in Sweden. The Buddhists had saunas 2,500 years ago. You know, you had descriptions on them and what they did, and just like saunas these days. So we saw this, you know, this was allowable, it's part of the tradition, so we decided to build a sauna, probably make the first one in any monastery in Thailand. Maybe first one in any monastery, was any, do they have monasteries, saunas in the Sri Lankan monasteries? Has anyone seen? No, but that's actually, that was part of the Jantagara, it was called, the fire room. That's actually part of the ancient monasteries. So, we saw that, we thought this might be good for our teacher's health. So we built the sauna, especially for Ajahn Chah. But not just for his health. We were a bit selfish too, because he lived in the monastery about 6 kilometers away. So if we built a sauna, he'd have to come and take his sauna in our monastery and at the same time give us a talk. So it was a great ruse, and it worked brilliantly. He'd come over once a week for his sauna, but he'd give a Dhamma talk first of all. He had your great teacher giving a Dhamma talk once a week. Brilliant idea. So, on one occasion he gave this really nice talk. Every now and again, you know, you just hit the spot and you get so inspired. And after the talk, I think many of you, if ever I've hit the spot here afterwards, you can sit in meditation so easy. You know, you get really great meditations after a good talk. And so I realised that was a really great talk. I thought, I'm not going to go and help him with his sauna and go around the back of the hall, find a quiet place and meditate. Because other monks were looking after him and I look after him most weeks. So I went back to the back of the hall. And I sat down meditation, of course, going to this really nice, blissful state. It's so lovely when you get into nice meditation. And after coming out of the meditation, my first thought, you know, oh, this is really, very nice, but where's my teacher? I should really do some service to him. Maybe there's still time. So I got up and started walking to the place where the sauna was. But I was too late, because Ajahn Chah had finished his sauna, but only just, and he was actually coming in the opposite direction with 2 Thai people going to his car. So we were going to cross on the path. And, like great teachers can see when you've had a good meditation. And Ajahn Chah obviously noticed I'd been in a deep meditation. And you felt him look right through you, as only great masters can. Sometimes you feel that when someone just goes right inside you, you know they're looking deep inside of you. But I wasn't really worried at all. I just had a beautiful meditation. And obviously Ajahn Chah saw that. So he decided to try and enlighten me there and then. He looked me right in the eye. When he looks like that, they grab your attention. You can't move. He said, Brahmavamsa, quite forcefully. Now, Ajahn Brahm is a shortened version. Brahmavamsa is the real name. Brahmavamsa, why? He asked me the question, why? Probably the deepest question anyone could ever ask. The question, why? You know what I replied? I don't know. I was a stupid monk. I was only young. And as soon as I said that, Ajahn Chah just laughed. Because these monks, they never punish you. They never get disappointed. When people are being stupid, like we are most of the time, you know, these monks, they think it's so funny. In fact, you know, having Western monks, real stupid monks, in his monastery must have given Ajahn Chah huge amounts of entertainment. Must have brightened up his day. For example, once I was learning Thai. And, you know, you learn Thai, and you sometimes get the pronunciations wrong. But also, at that particular time, whenever we needed any requisites, you know, there was no, like, storeroom, we'd go to Ajahn Chah's hut and had this big water jar. And when people would come and offer him things, just go in the jar. He wouldn't keep anything to himself. And when everyone wanted anything, it was toothpaste, he'd just go there and look in the jar, oh, here's some, take that. I needed some soap. Because I'd run out of soap, and I went and asked for some soap. But the word for soap is sabu. And because my Thai was not so good, I said sapo. And sapo means pineapple. So Ajahn Chah scratches his head and said, what do you ask for? I said, pineapple. Well, what do you want a pineapple for? And because I didn't know Thai very well, I said, no, to wash my body. He'll never let me forget that. He said, Ajahn Brahm, he washes his body. It's amazing what they do in the West. It's a very strange culture. They wash with pineapples. So we entertained him, no end. So it was really good fun having silly Westerners around. You wouldn't get that sort of entertainment anywhere other place. So he laughed uproariously when I said, I don't know. But then he looked me in the eye again. He was obviously being serious again. And he said, listen, I'll tell you the answer. I'll tell you the answer to the question why. Anybody ever ask that of you again, this is the answer. And I was really interested. Because now, this was a great monk. And he was giving me just not a teaching out of the suttas, not something you can actually read for yourself, but this amazing one-on-one encounter. And the seeing I've been in a deep meditation and giving me the answer to the question why. He looked me in the eye and said, the answer to the question why is, there's nothing. There's nothing. He said, do you understand? I said, yes. He said, no, you don't. And I usually say after that, tell that story, do you understand? Say, you don't either. But what a brilliant answer. The answer to the question why is nothing. Now you understand what anatta means. Nothing there. All gone. No consciousness. No words. No doing. There's nothing. Can you see it? Can you? Can you? No, you can't. Okay, so that's the talk on like deep insight today, because we've gone over at 9 o'clock. Any questions about that? Yeah.
It's sort of magnanimity in a way all along, and while we're meditating here, we see when we do see a dhyana, then I suppose we'll see everything we give away, but in the meantime, I kind of imaginarily give away.
You can imagine we give away, but when you imagine, the difference between imagination and reality is so slight, it hardly matters. If you imagine that you're giving things away, you're encouraging yourself to give things away.
See, the problem is back up in mind and you're still there.
You're still there, but after a while, you give away a little and you get so much happiness and freedom. So you give away a little more and you get more happiness. You get this reward straight away every time you give up. And you give away. You have less of a burden. Less things to worry about. and become so much easier and freer. So we're not talking about the material things here. We're talking about the mental stuff. All those sorts of things, especially your expectations and wanting. Instead of wanting things, this is actually what another Ajahn Chah say, is that we meditate not to get things, we meditate to give things away. Great saying, because if you're meditating to try and get more experiences, more jhanas, to improve your meditation, which is like getting more brownie badges or more stripes on your robe until you get, you know, a couple of pips in the crown, means you're a general monk. This is not what you do it for, that's worldly stuff. You're doing things to give it away. See how much you can abandon. Abandon all your past, all your future, all your thoughts, all your senses. Everything you think you own. What do you own? Give it all away. None of my business. Until you've got nothing left at all.
Are we not trying to gain something like the
minister? If you are, you never get it. Because these aren't attainments. These are stages of letting go. That's why, you know, I coined that term, stages of letting go. If you let go a lot, you get to that stage. Let go even more, you go deeper. Let go a lot, you get to jhanas. If you think of them as attainments, you miss the point, you never find them. The same as I said with the arrow falling down between your feet. They're already there, you don't have to go out and get them. They're here, but they're covered with these layers and layers and layers. And you have to let go of these layers. Let them go, abandon, give them up. You let go and throw away more and more, you go deeper into the prize in the center. It's not an attainment. Attainment is something you get for over there or over there. This, you already have it. So what do you mean attaining? It's just buried deep inside. Inside this moment. You've got to let go of things, let go of things, let go of things. Until you find out what's underneath. So, I'm labouring on that point, but it's an important point. It's the difference between experiencing the jhanas and experiencing lots and lots of frustration. You're just going in the wrong direction. Why is it not working? Because you're trying to get over there instead of coming in here. Another similar way of talking about the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha always, very often, the Four Noble Truths would always be with the asavas. Not just suffering, he'd talk about the asavas. Sometimes they call them the taints or the cankers, which is a rotten word. I just call them asavas. You've got the asavas, the cause of the asavas, the end of the asavas, and the way leading to the end of the asavas. Similar to the Four Noble Truths, but with asavas instead of dukkha. And the asavas means the outflowings of the mind. The mind going out into time, out into the world, out into something. It's always going outwards. And that's actually the force of the mind. The current of craving, which is always going out from where you are to somewhere else, to something else, anything else than being in here. He said that force and that current is equivalent to suffering. He said meditation is going the opposite direction, abandoning that force which throws you out, looking for enlightenment, looking for peace, looking for fulfillment, whatever, out there somewhere. The coverings of the jhanas are basically the five senses in the body, and also the doing, but especially the five senses in the body. That's what really sort of obstructs. You've got to let those five senses go and the body disappear, and also the doer, the controller. Just peel them away. So no senses left, no doing left. And what's left underneath there? Nimitta, first of all. And underneath that nimitta is the jhana. So it's easy, just sit there and just allow things just to fade away, to drop off you like a snake sloughing its skin. Like all this rubbish stuff just going away. And please don't be like one of those worms in that pile of dung. I've got two more days left to pull you out. So please give me a break and come.
Okay, so there we go. That's the talk this evening about some deep insights. Oh, this morning, sorry. And now we have the interview times. There's interview again for some of the people. It's on the board there. Don't worry, tomorrow is also an interview day, but tomorrow there will be a blank sheet up there. And first come, first serve, you can put your name down and just come in line. So it can be anyone, whoever wants, they can put their name down for the interrogations. Interviews, I'm sorry. Okay, so today's interviews are on the board there. You're most welcome to come. Okay, so have a nice day.